I want to first, as we try to often do when we have somebody back, is first go back. And now that you have thought about what you said last week and people have commented on your on the article that I wrote about our interview last week and listening to that interview again, is there any do you stand by all of what you said last week?
Sure, sure. But there are a few points that I want to make, you know, particularly in response to some of the comments. And first point I want to make is that what I accused the former deans of is far less egregious than what Levine and Smith and some others have been accusing athletics and academic support of. My accusation was negligence. They've been talking about malfeasance and collusion. And so I think that's important to note. And as I noted last week, negligence is a far less sensational scandal. It doesn't sell as many headlines as what Smith and Levine are talking about. And then furthermore, another point is that I was not trying to lay blame exclusively on Levine and Smith. That wasn't my point. My point was that all of the former deans who had or who should have had some responsibility for monitoring and supporting educational quality are culpable. It's a system that's culpable. So I'll even apologize if I overemphasized or even misunderstood the extent of Levine's and Smith's culpability. They're not the only ones, but they are part of those deans who had that responsibility, and so they are culpable. I highlighted them specifically because of how hypocritically they have been pointing their fingers at athletics and academic support. And I use that term hypocrite very intentionally. I'm reminded of the lesson from the Sermon on the Mount. Why do you point out the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye when you have a plank in your own eye? First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you'll see to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Well, the plank that is in Levine's and Smith's eye is the administrative structure that they were a part of that allowed a professor to go more than a decade without showing up to most of his classes. And so that's why I point out their hypocrisy. I think if Smith was genuine about reform, instead of having started an athletics reform group a couple years ago, he would have started an administrative reform group. And the purpose would have been something like restructuring the responsibility of the deans so as to monitor and support educational quality more effectively. And so the last point I'll make is just that I don't enjoy talking about this negligence. I would prefer to talk about the excellence that I think is more characteristic of UNC. And this is what I said in my email to Chancellor Folt last summer. I said that there's a real culture of excellence that permeates UNC. And I'd rather talk about that than a couple oversights. But as long as Levine and Smith and others keep clamoring about this, I'm going to speak up because I'm not one to remain silent while hypocrites shout so loudly.
UNC did an internal review which found that less than 6% of the 176 students in Mary Willingham's study read below an eighth grade equivalent. Her study and what she's been saying is that, I believe I have this number right, 60% read below a 12th grade level. So we're essentially not college ready is what she's been saying.
She claims 60% below high school.
Below high school,
yeah,
right.
She said 60% below high school and another 10% below fourth grade.
Right. So is the 6%, do you think admitting that kind of a number of student athletes, do you think that is okay even to have that number, or should it be 100% 12th grade and above?
That's a great question. I think that unless we can do some sort of reading assessment for all the recruits, that it would be really hard to determine. It would be really difficult to completely eliminate any new students who have below a 12th grade reading level. And so, as I've said, admissions needed to be improved, and it has been improved, but it's not going to be perfect. And I think it's going to keep improving. And so Is it possible that going forward there will be students who read below a 12th grade level, maybe even below a 9th grade level? I suppose it's possible. And so rather than say we absolutely should not admit any students at that level, I think a more thoughtful statement or a more thoughtful commitment would be to say we are going to be committed to making sure that everyone we admit is capable of succeeding at UNC.
Obviously, there are special admits for student athletes. There's special admits for non-student athletes as well. Mm-hmm. People, you know, even Steve Farmer, the director of undergraduate admissions, has said that he wants to take a comprehensive look at the resume of students. It's not mm-hmm. just about the grades. He wants right. to look at extracurriculars and things like that. Have you seen any kind of numbers that point to, I know you deal with student athletes a lot, mm-hmm. but have you seen any kind of numbers that point to the fact that there are non-student athletes that are at the same level as what we're talking about right now with student athletes, that mm-hmm. maybe that this is not an anomaly, mm-hmm. but only that student athletes are being targeted at this point?
Right. That's an interesting question. And I haven't, because I only work with student athletes. I don't know what the numbers for or what the academic profiles for the underprepared or academically challenged non-athletes are. But, you know, it might be worth looking at how many of the special admits in music or in drama or in art are comparable academically to the non-athletes, and you know, perhaps it should be a goal that the athletes who are admitted are not significantly more underprepared than the other specially admitted students. But again, I don't work with any of the non-student athletes.
We're joined by UNC Learning Specialist and author of Coaching the Mind, Bradley Bethel. And Bradley, somebody actually emailed me last week after our interview, or called in, I believe, and asked if I would ask this question. And this is something that I'd like to hear about as well. How does this, the academic scandal that's going on, I know a lot of people have been talking about it's a national issue, but of what you've seen, how does this compare to other universities? And someone even commented, a lot of UNC, NC State talk going back and forth. Someone commented on the article from last week saying that NC State caught its problems before they got out of control. Do you have any insight on that?
No, not really, because, you know, the truth is I'm not a student or a scholar of NCAA history and NCAA scandals. And one point that I have made, though, in some back and forth on Twitter, is I know that NC State had a scandal in the 80s, I believe it was. And the point I made is that I am sure that the media sensationalized that scandal in the same way that they're sensationalizing the UNC scandal. So whatever came out in the media about NC State's scandal 20, 30 years ago, I'm sure the truth, the reality of that scandal was not as bad as how the media ran it. You know, I will say, though, that I think there's this idea out there I've heard from, I think Smith has actually said this, as well as David Ridpath at Ohio University, Gerald Gurney at Oklahoma University, that the UNC scandal is the worst in NCAA history, at least the worst athletic scandal in NCAA history. And that I find striking. For one reason is they like to throw out this number of the 500 plus unauthorized grade changes to support their assertion that this is the worst scandal in NCAA history. But there's a major problem with that, is that 500 plus number includes athletes and non-athletes. That is not 500 plus grade changes, unauthorized grade changes, just for athletes. It includes non-athletes. And so I think what we really need to look at the numbers, which most of the Dan Kane and other journalists have really been complacent in doing. They've cited this 500. Dan Kane has cited this 500 plus number. Paul Barrett has cited it. But again, it's not the fair number because it includes non-athletes. I mean, we look at the data we have, The good data we have, it goes from 2001 to 2012. And during that time in the paper classes, student athletes took 231, or there were 231 unauthorized or suspected unauthorized grade changes. It's not 500 some, they're 231. Now, the point is, actually, I'm sorry, that's 253. There are 253. 231 is the number of temporary grade changes. This is significant because there's a difference between temporary and permanent grade changes. Temporary grade changes are actually fairly commonplace at the university. This is where a student has something happen during the semester, says to the professor, hey, I'm not going to be able to finish this final paper by the deadline. Can you give me an incomplete and I'll get it 2 weeks after the semester and, or, you know, or whatever. And the professor says, okay, I'll give you your grade then. So these 231, they're temporary grade changes. They're fairly commonplace. And they comprise 91% of the unauthorized or suspected authorized grade changes for athletes. So what that leaves us with is 22 permanent grade changes for athletes, not the 500s. I mean, I think this is the number people should be talking about is 22, not the 500 some. Now, of course, anything other than zero is inexcusable. There's obviously something amiss here. However, there's no evidence of any of these unauthorized or suspected unauthorized grade changes outside of AFAM. So when we look at these 22 over 12 years, that's 22 out of 96,000 grades that UNC athletes would have accumulated over that 12-year period. 22 out of 96,000. Now, if we want to assume that these 22 grade changes were just men's basketball and football, then that's still 22 out of the 13,440 total grades that, or that's an estimate, by the way, that football and men's basketball players would have gotten throughout their careers over that 12-year period. So that's still less than 1%. Now, another important point to make about this 22 unauthorized or suspected unauthorized permanent grade changes for athletes. And that same period in these classes, there were 75 of these grade changes for non-athletes. 22 for athletes, 75 for non-athletes. So although the enrollment, athletes did have a disproportionately high enrollment in the paper classes. It was 45% athletes, 55% non-athletes. So that was disproportionately high for athletes. But when we look at the students who were in the classes, the students who comprised the classes, non-athletes actually had a proportionally higher rate of the grade changes. It was of the unauthorized permanent grade changes. 77% of the unauthorized permanent grade changes were for non-athletes. Only 23% of them were for athletes. So the conclusion I draw from this is that if this was the biggest scandal in NCAA history, then NCAA's history is a lot cleaner than I thought it was.
Now, another phrase that's been used, we've been talking, and you said last week that academic scandal is, in your words, unfortunately, the proper way of deeming this. Another phrase that's been used in talking about this is fake classes, that there were fake classes. Do you think that that is a proper representation, that there were fake classes, or were they, we know paper classes has been used a lot. What about fake classes?
Fake class. Were they fake class? Well, I don't know if fake is the right word, but they definitely weren't what they should have been. They were not the, as it says on the website for the Office of Curricula, they were not the outstanding research-based, academically rigorous classes that UNC is supposed to have. So that's what I said. Again, I don't know if I would call them fake because there was something to do. And the other point I would make about that is I don't even think Julius Nyangaro thought they were fake. When you look at going back to some of the numbers, when you get into the reports on some of the classes, in the enrollments in those classes, you don't see a pattern of a professor who believes that what he's doing is wrong. For example, in the spring of 2004, he taught a class, AFRI 120. In that class, there were 158 students. Only 45 were athletes. So that means there were over 100 non-athletes in this paper class. Now, how is somebody who thinks that this is wrong, that what he's doing is wrong, how is somebody who's trying to keep what he's doing a secret, possibly gonna convince 100-some non-athletes not to talk about this paper class? And there are other classes. In the fall of 2003, there was a class with 95 students, only 35 athletes. So that's 60 non-athletes who would be talking to their advisors, talking to their friends about this paper class. So when we actually look at the numbers and look at the patterns that emerge, what we see is not the behavior of somebody who is trying to hide something, but somebody who believes they are perfectly within their rights to do what they are doing. So I don't even think Nayengaro thought that his classes were fake, and so I'm not necessarily comfortable with that term fake either.
We're speaking with UNC learning specialist and author of Coaching the Mind, Bradley Bethel. How many people have contacted you challenging what you've said? And I'm going to say outside of what we've seen, in addition to what we've seen on the article just last week.
Well, I've blocked a lot of people on Twitter, so there are probably a lot more who would like to contact me and challenge me via Twitter. I have not blocked many people on my blog because I want the comment section to be an open forum for discussion. But I have blocked some who were being especially rude or irrational. And quite honestly, on my blog, sometimes the comments just get so out of hand, I can't even keep up. But sometimes I respond. I try to keep up, at least to some extent, and respond. And I've gotten a few emails challenging me, but most of the emails I've gotten have been supportive. Now, I'm not going to claim, Mary Willingham claims she's gotten thousands of supportive emails. I've gotten a few dozen. So I guess I'm still behind Mary Willingham's thousands.
Any death threats?
No death threats. No okay. death threats, fortunately. So I've had challenges, and most of them have been reasonable, but
in the supportive ones, are there any professors or people with UNC faculty staff ties that have talked up? Because I know Mary Willingham and Jay Smith came on our airwaves and said that we're going to hear a number of people come out after they did in support of what they said. And a lot of them were with UNC ties. I don't think we've heard those numbers step up. We have heard the former UNC faculty that signed the letter to the university with the anger, if you will. but as far as UNC faculty and staff that have supported you, have you heard many of them?
I have had some emails from faculty members, and that's been especially rewarding to get an email from somebody who says, "I've been teaching here for 30 years, and I appreciate that you're putting this work in to trying to make the truth known." And the most rewarding compliment I've gotten it a few times was people appreciating that I wasn't just defending the university or anybody else, but the fact that I have been critical. I have been willing to say, here are some things we did wrong. We should have had better admissions. The deans should have been more responsible. So I've had people point out that they take me more seriously because I'm willing to acknowledge that not everything has been perfect.
Do you think UNC should step up more and say that?
Well, the challenge to that is that UNC is limited in what they can say about individuals, because we have rights. We have federal and state protected rights as employees and former employees. An employer can't just start coming out and saying, "Well, this person wasn't very good at his job." And this is something that some of these retired faculty members want. They want the university to come out and say, well, these coaches didn't value academics enough. But the thing is that would be perceived, that could be perceived as a defaming statement against those coaches, in which case the coaches could turn around and sue and say, you've made my ability to get a job at another university more difficult. And so I don't blame the university for not saying more, for not taking more responsibility. I blame some individuals, some. I mean, talking about the deans, I think that some of the deans should have stepped forward and they should have said, hey, this is our fault. We dropped the ball on this. And frankly, I think if some deans had stepped forward 3 years ago and said, we allowed this to happen, I think that the course of the narrative that has taken place in the media would have been much different. I don't think it would have been as sensationalized. I don't think it would have dragged out the way it has. And so, you know, if there's one thing I wish could have happened, I think that's the one thing, is that some of the individual deans would have stepped up and said, we take responsibility.
We're joined by Bradley Bethel, the UNC Learning Specialist and author of Coaching the Mind. Bradley, Kenneth Weinstein has been tasked with letting the evidence take him where it takes him. That's what people have been talking about. And this is not a review that is led by UNC in any direction. They have asked Kenneth Weinstein to take it where it will. He served as the first Assistant Attorney General for National Security and later as the Homeland Security Advisor to the United States President George W. Bush. He is an attorney and has been tasked with this this review and this investigation. What are your thoughts on where he is going with this investigation?
Well, what I know is that he is being very thorough. He is... had access to more people, more resources than any of the previous investigations. And so, excuse me, I feel confident, I think most people feel confident, that if there is something to uncover, he is going to uncover it. And I have said before, he very well could. My point about this scandal being an academic scandal was that that's based on the evidence we have so far. Any suggestion that there's an athletic scandal, that there's collusion or malfeasance is just conjecture and insinuation. But maybe he reveals something. And you know what? I've been very encouraged by people in the university who have said, we want to know. If there was some wrongdoing, we want to know. We don't want to hide. There's this, Jay Smith and others claim that the university, the authorities are trying to hide stuff or hide something. But from my impression, I don't think anybody's trying to hide anything. They want to know the truth. And so my biggest concern is, if something is revealed, how will the media report it? You know, to what extent are they going to sensationalize it the way they've sensationalized so much? And what comes to mind specifically is I think of the first article in the NNO about Mary Willingham. The title of the article was something like "Academic Support Staff Tolerates Cheating." Well, when you read the article, actually, Mary Willingham gave one example of one academic counselor who didn't follow through on Mary's accusation of cheating. Mary said that she had worked with a women's basketball player, and she thought that the women's basketball player cheated, and she reported it to the counselor, and the counselor said not to worry about it. Now, maybe that happened. Maybe the women's basketball player at that time did in fact not exhibit due diligence on that case. That does not mean that the entire academic support program should be characterized as tolerating cheating because of one person. And so going back to the Weinstein report, I just hope that if he finds something, I hope he doesn't, and I hope that's the truth, but if he does find something and it's one person, if it's two people, I just hope that the media doesn't run with it and say that this is evidence or this illustrates what we've been saying, that the whole system was corrupt. So we'll just have to see what Weinstein finds.
Do you think if he doesn't find anything, and the Martin report was not a big, here's a bunch of new information. Yes, it sent the scandal back further than I think many people thought it was taking place.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a new revelation of any kind of scandal. It kept it on the academic side. It didn't uncover athletics as being a major problem. And so it didn't really die down. Do you think if Weinstein doesn't find anything, that this will be enough evidence for people to believe that, or do you think there will still be skepticism that there are problems out there?
I think it'll be enough for the people that matter. I think it'll be enough for the people in the middle in general, you know, whether they're part of UNC or not. But they're going to continue to be the ABCers, as they're referred to, all but Carolina, the detractors who are just convinced. And when you read some of the Twitter comments, it just seems like some of these people, their whole lives revolve around criticizing UNC, and you know, and so they will believe what they want in the face of all evidence to the contrary. And so, but those people, their opinions don't matter. And so I think that Weinstein's report is going to be definitive. It's going to be final. It's going to close the book on this. At least I really hope it will.